From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll speak with a recent heart attack survivor about the importance of learning how heart disease often presents differently in women.
Even waiting to be seen, I was embarrassed. I thought, well, this is ridiculous. They're going to take a look at me and say you have indigestion, give me a prescription-level antacid, and send me home. Well, that's not what happened.
Then we'll tell you about a new book on Milwaukee's geological architecture. Plus, we'll learn what's happening with Milwaukee's first cheese factory after Clock Shadow Creamery closed up shop.
It is unusual. Though we're not the only urban cheese factory, it is rare, it is unusual. We like it.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Heart disease is the number one cause of death for women in the United States and can affect women at any age. Despite the prevalence of heart disease in women, most don't know how to recognize the symptoms, especially since they're often different from men's. This was the case for Linda Kiewit, who suffered a heart attack in January. Linda is in her 50s and in overall good health, so she never suspected that some stubborn GI discomfort was the onset of a heart attack. She's currently continuing treatment at the Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin's Cardiac Rehab Center and has made it her personal mission to share her story in hopes that fewer women will experience what she has. Linda and her doctor, Stacy Gardner, join me now to share more about heart attacks and how they present in women. Linda begins by sharing what she was experiencing before she was admitted for emergency treatment for a heart attack.
I never was guessing I would have a heart attack. I didn't believe it until they told me I was. And that was after a lot of things happening that were finally convincing me that was the case. So I had had a surgery 10 days prior, moved into the holidays, and then shortly afterward, you know, started back at work. I noticed that I was having kind of indigestion and a little bit of heartburn. And that continued for a couple days. I have a history of reflux. I assumed it was reflux. I was treating like it was reflux, but it wouldn't quite go away. At the same time, it wasn't constant. It wasn't alarming. It was something that I thought, hey, maybe this is something related to post-surgery. Maybe I'm eating wrong coming out of the holidays. There's always an intense time for eating. Maybe I'd eaten oddly then. Just really didn't anticipate it. And then finally, on the final morning, I'd switched medications again. I woke up. I felt like, hey, this is going away. And then it came back. So then I called my surgeon, and he immediately said, you know what, I think you need to have this checked out. So that's when I went to the hospital. And even waiting to be seen, I was embarrassed. I thought, well, this is ridiculous. They're going to, you know, take a look at me and say you have indigestion, give me a prescription-level antacid, and send me home. Well, that's not what happened.
And how many days of indigestion did you say it was?
It started on a Wednesday, and I went in on Saturday morning.
Okay, so prolonged indigestion problems. And then what was that conversation like when they told you what was actually happening?
It was traumatizing. They initially took my blood pressure. They were concerned. They then immediately took an EKG, and the EKG was so alarming, they thought they had made a mistake, and they took another one right away. And my husband later told me he was facing the EKG technician. I was not. He saw the EKG technician's face change and knew we were in trouble. So then they called what they call rapid response and told me a lot of people would be entering my area. They were there to take care of me. And then they continued to take steps to save me. In the ER, a lot was happening very quickly and in a very reassuring way as a patient, as reassured as you can be in that situation. But we immediately, both my husband and I knew immediately that there was something very wrong. At the same time, ER chaos is an odd thing. I'm not a huge fan of ER shows, but that's what it reminded me of.
Yeah.
Because it's controlled chaos. Everybody's doing exactly what they know they're supposed to be doing. At the same time, as someone who doesn't know what's happening, you are understanding the seriousness of it. And then when they were communicating to me what was going to happen next, they were calling in a cath team, and they were explaining to me what they were going to do. I started questioning them and said, why would you do this? What is actually happening? And then they gave me more information, and that's when I got very scared.
So then they explicitly stated you're having a heart attack.
They used words that explain that without being over-alarming to maintain some level of calm.
Mm-hmm.
They had lots of resources come in and, you know, be with my husband because he was standing there alone watching me have it and seeing everything that was happening. Him and I immediately communicated about different people to call and what to do next. And you do what you do when you know that you're in a very serious health situation that you're not sure if you're going to come out of.
So the onset was indigestion. That's something I would never assume is an indicator of a heart attack. So Dr. Gardner, you treated Linda. And with this presentation of symptoms, it can be different for anyone, but symptoms do differ somewhat in women compared to men, right? Can you walk us through some of the common indicators that we might not be thinking about?
Sure. Linda, thank you for sharing your story. So it's still important to remember that for all comers, both men and women, that chest pain, chest pressure, chest heaviness, however you want to describe it, discomfort in the chest is still the most common symptom for both men and women. But it is true that women tend to have more unusual symptoms. Indigestion is definitely a presentation I have heard on multiple occasions, in addition to other things, extreme exhaustion, excessive, tiredness, nausea, pain in other places, jaw pain, back pain, shoulder pain, neck pain. And the presentation can be different for everybody. And we have to really be extra vigilant, I think, in women because they are more likely to have these atypical symptoms. I should also say shortness of breath would be a really common one in women. So when you hear these sort of things, it does raise some alarms.
Now, Linda, you mentioned you were slightly embarrassed to go in or were expecting to just kind of be told off and, you know, you're just experiencing this, you know, here you go, come back another time. But, you know, this is an example of women who wait longer to get treatment, not just for heart attacks, for a lot of things, but women wait almost 40 hours longer than men when it comes to heart attack treatment. So, I mean, Linda, you can speak about this personally, but Dr. Gardner, I'm interested in your perspective as well. You know, why is this?
I think it's a multitude of factors, but I think that women in general are caregivers. They tend to worry a lot about the people around them, the people they love, and sometimes they put themselves on the back burner and might not even realize the symptoms that they're having and have a tendency to sometimes ignore really alarming symptoms. But that being said, historically, most of what we understand about heart disease was done on studies that were mostly conducted on middle-aged men. And that's changed now, but if you look at sort of the representation in clinical trials, women are still underrepresented in clinical trials. And so what we understand about heart disease and how to treat heart disease is still not completely reflective of women. So I think that women may ignore their symptoms. That leads to a delay. Medical professionals may not take the symptoms seriously initially, especially if they don't have as many traditional risk factors. And this all leads to delays in diagnosis and delays in treatment.
Do you feel differently about things, Linda? I mean, I imagine your experience, you're cautioning everyone to, you know, don't ignore or watch out for things.
Yeah, everything changes, to be frank. It changes in the best ways. And it also, I guess it's the best way. Everything changes. But, you know, everything clarifies very quickly in those moments. It's supposed to. And part of your healing is also supposed to be that you forget some of it, which is good. It's a good thing. But in terms of how I feel about my body now, I'm incredibly in tune to it. I need to be because there's certain things I need to look for to ensure I don't run into trouble again. While in the ICU after, I said, I need to get the word out about this because I'm of a certain age. I'm very young, relatively healthy to have a heart attack, but I had it, and I had what they call the widowmaker. It was as serious as it gets, and so I talked to everyone about it, which is sometimes a little bit TMI, but it's really important, and this is another example, I think, of women, is that we are often unlikely to share some of the hardest parts that we're dealing with our health because we're somehow made to feel guilty if we're not in our best shape. But we also, as caregivers and as, you know, childbearers, our bodies go through a lot. We take on a lot. We have to take care of ourselves. You know, when I was in the hospital, my cardiologist there, you know, he said, you're going to have a part-time job, which is taking care of your heart for a while. And that means a completely different diet, focusing on myself, learning to say no, so that I can really focus my energy on things that are important to me, and going to cardiac rehab. Because the thing about the rehab is that I'm unfortunately part of a club that you don't really want to be a part of anymore, and that's someone who's had, you know, a heart attack. And not many people understand what that's like. So it's helpful to have people there, too, to talk to. And, you know, the care team there understands it, and that helps a lot as well. So it's the upside of this very hard situation.
I guess I would also add that sort of as part of the post-heart attack journey is that we really want to focus on risk factors. So whether you've never had a heart attack or you've already had a heart attack, we really concentrate on optimizing your risk factors. And so for both men and women, the number one risk factors are smoking, diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity, sedentary lifestyle, high cholesterol. Those are the things that we focus on. However, there really are some unique risk factors that we should pay attention to in women. Things like gestational diabetes, so diabetes in pregnancy, hypertension in pregnancy, those actually give you an increased risk of having cardiac events later on in life. Premature menopause, so menopause before age 40 will increase your risk for cardiac events. Things like depression, which are a little bit more common in women. But even if you look at things like inflammatory conditions, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, those conditions are more common in women, but also are what we would consider risk enhancers. They do enhance your risk for later cardiac events. So yes, even though you have already had a heart attack and the horse is out of the barn, we really have to optimize all of those risk factors the best we can to prevent subsequent events.
Right. I would like to actually put an exclamation point on that, because when I was in the hospital post-heart attack, the cardiologist asked me a number of questions, and I kept saying yes, yes, yes. There were risk factors I didn't know I had. Mm. And it may have altered some choices I made in my lifestyle if I had known that. And the gestational diabetes is a perfect example of that. I had never had that conversation before. So that awareness alone can really help someone understand their potential risk.
Linda Kiewit is a recent heart attack survivor, and Dr. Stacy Gardner is an assistant professor at Fratert and the Medical College of Wisconsin, and also one of the people that treated Linda. You can hear an extended version of our conversation at WUWM.com. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. Later in the show, we'll learn about some changes happening with Milwaukee's urban cheese producer. But first, we'll learn about Milwaukee geological architecture. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. You've heard of Cream City Brick, but how about Wauwatosa Dollastone, Crossville Sandstone, or Larvikite Monzonite? While not receiving the same notoriety as Cream City Bricks, these type of stone are found in buildings all across Milwaukee. Raymond Wiggers is a geologist, science writer, and author of the new book, Milwaukee in Stone and Clay, which chronicles dozens of different types of rocks that buildings in our city are made of, and how they got there. He joins Lake Effect's Sam Woods to talk about the book and his longtime interest in Milwaukee's architectural geology.
Ray, you're the author of a new book titled Milwaukee in Stone and Clay, which is a tour of sorts of Milwaukee's geological architecture, i.e. where the stones and building materials in Milwaukee's lasting buildings were originally sourced in the history of how they got to the buildings that they're in today. But before we get into the book, I want to know more about your background and your connection to Milwaukee.
Sure. Well, actually, I am a person who grew up about halfway between Milwaukee and Chicago. So I always had this kind of bipolar idea of what a city should be. I had Milwaukee on one side. My family often went to Milwaukee. We often went to Chicago. My dad worked in Chicago. And so those were the two great cities of my life up through about the time I was in high school. And I had always been interested both in architecture and in geology, a little bit more so in geology. So when I went to college at Purdue University, I got my degree in geology. And then in the many years since then, I have gotten more and more into the field, not only of professional geology, but also into the world of science writing. And I've done a number of books, several books now in primarily the fields of geology. And after, in the late 90s, I came out with a book on the geology, the general geology of Illinois. And in that book, there was one chapter on the architectural geology of Chicago, and that was actually the most popular chapter in the entire book. I started this research program over the entire area, back to my, you know, childhood haunts in Milwaukee, going up as far as Door County, going all the way over to Montello and Portage and Baraboo. And I started the series. In fact, I after teaching college for about 20 years, I retired and started the series on architectural geology.
Tell me about your research process for this book, because right now I'm imagining you going block to block, revisiting those old childhood haunts in Milwaukee and seeing them through new eyes. But I'm guessing there was a little bit more to your research process than just visiting old buildings you remembered.
Yeah, that's certainly part of it. That's what the geologists call the field work. So that's where you're actually, you know, walking around, actually looking at what we call, you know, the rock outcrop or the exposure. In this case, it's a building that has this wonderful rock, or it has this geologically derived clay or terracotta or metal on it. And that's part of the process. And certainly talking to people, talking to the building managers, talking to the architects who designed it. I've had some wonderful conversations with architects, for example, who designed 100 East, you know, or the Faison building over by the river on Wisconsin Avenue. And you get a lot of wonderful perspective from people who were actually part of the construction process. But we also are dealing with buildings that were built in 1870, 1861, and so on and so forth. So you really have to delve into the historical record and look at the, as historians call them, the primary sources, which involve looking at a lot of trade journals, a lot of newspaper articles. One of my favorite subjects in the book was the great mythic Lake Emily that's supposedly under the Northwestern Mutual building. And I found a wonderful journal, Sentinel. It was the Milwaukee Sentinel in those days. It was the Milwaukee Sentinel writing this wonderful historical analysis of Lake Emily when it still existed. So you have to dig into the, you know, into the archives. I spent a lot of time, for example, at the Milwaukee County Historical Society archives, and people there were very helpful. A lot of time at the Milwaukee Public Library. So it's been a mixture, but yes, a lot of time on the ground, actually looking and analyzing the materials right in front of you.
When I think of architecture in Milwaukee, my mind immediately goes to Cream City Bricks. They have an established association with Milwaukee as a common building material, and of course, even contribute to one of the city's nicknames, the Cream City. And while you see a lot of instances of buildings that use Cream City brick that are included in this book, many of them contain materials other than Cream City brick. And I'm curious, is it possible to draw conclusions about the economic history of the city from the building materials used? Like, for example, if a building is made primarily of materials sourced from outside the Midwest, is it fair to assume that the original owner of the building was wealthier than the owner of a building made primarily from Cream City brick, which was sourced locally?
Yes, absolutely. So originally, when the field of architectural geology began back in the early 1800s, it was conceived of as being a part of economic geology, which is this field that involves quarrying stone and, of course, you know, fossil fuels and everything else. But you can tell a lot about what people were able to build with and how much they had to spend on it. For example, I'll give you one wonderful example. A lot of wonderful buildings in Milwaukee, of course, are made of Cream City brick. There's the Brown Double House, and there's the Matthew Keenan Townhouse, and the Pfister Hotel, and many very beautiful buildings. they used a higher grade of Cream City brick, which meant that they were spending more money. But if you wanted to be really showy and really show off how much money you were spending, you imported Philadelphia brick, okay, all the way from Philadelphia. And that's a very deep red brick. And you're really showing off that you have a lot of money to spend on your architectural project. And there's one very good example of that. Once again, right next to the Pfister Hotel, and that's the Milwaukee Club, which is one of my favorite buildings. It's just a beautiful building made of Philadelphia brick.
One thing I love about this book is its treatment of rocks and stones and inorganic matter as markers of history. And I think it's interesting when we typically are thinking of the history of Milwaukee, the story usually starts around 1846 when the city was officially established, or maybe sometime in the last few millennia when indigenous nations lived or migrated through here. But in this book, you ask readers to consider Milwaukee on a geological timescale, you know, stretching back millions of years to when the land that is now Milwaukee was actually located south of the equator and underwater, like just a very different experience than what we have today. And so I'm curious for you, as someone who's kind of thinking about geological timescales and time as, you know, in terms of millions of years, when you consider Milwaukee's history on a timescale of millions of years, what is revealed to you? What do you get from that kind of thinking and understanding of place?
A colossal sense of awe. When you realize, first of all, your true size, not only in the, you know, in the scope of the entire universe, but also in the scope of geologic time, it's a very humbling experience, but also it's a very exhilarating experience if you know how to handle it correctly. So, you know, our planet's history begins about 4.5 billion, a little bit more than 4.5 billion years ago. And the main bedrock that sits under Milwaukee, actually, there's some slightly younger bedrock up in the northern part of Milwaukee County, but it's about 425 million years old. And a lot of the buildings, including the Pfister Hotel, are clad in this wonderful stone. It's called the Wauwatosa Dolostone. That's the geological name for it. Actually, it's the Wauwatosa Limestone or Milwaukee County Limestone to everybody else. But anyway, this stone, you know, was actually formed when Milwaukee and the whole Midwestern region were part of a precursor continent called Laurentia that was situated about 30 degrees south of the equator. And we were covered by a shallow saltwater sea filled with coral reefs and all sorts of wonderful creatures. This is still about, well, roughly 200 million years before the rise, the real rise of the dinosaurs. So this is going back. But I can take you or anyone else to one of the great buildings. Once again, I keep mentioning Wisconsin Avenue in Milwaukee, but to the Wisconsin Gas Building, or to the what I still call the Warner Building, or over to the Wisconsin Tower. And the cladding or the stone that's used on the lower ground level part of that building is something called Morton Gneiss. That rock is 3.52 billion years old, or at least the oldest part of it. That is 3/4 the age of the solar system. And so I always tell my tour participants, put your hand on it, and that's the oldest earthly material you'll touch in your fleeting life. That's it right there.
Wow. I don't even know how to follow that up, but I'll try. On that note, you mentioned you grew up spending some time in Milwaukee and Chicago. As you've studied geological architecture and as you've led geological architecture tours in this city and, you know, put your hand on something that's 3.5 billion years old, how has your appreciation or understanding of Milwaukee changed through kind of thinking about this for years?
Well, it's changed tremendously. I'm not the youngest person in the world. And I can remember going up with my family to Milwaukee in the late 1950s and early 1960s. And I can remember, for those of your listeners who are a little older, the Pabst Building, which was the first skyscraper in town, which is where 100 East is located now. And so I remember sort of the old Milwaukee of the Milwaukee Braves era. And things have changed, of course, tremendously in every American city. American cities change and morph so quickly compared to European cities, but Milwaukee certainly has changed. I didn't really start studying the architectural history or really look in depth at the geology of Milwaukee until I retired from college teaching around 2017. And then I just fell madly in love with Milwaukee. It is such a wonderful city for any geologist to spend years in and just studying the different geologic materials in it. And also the architectural history is amazing. People just don't realize outside of Milwaukee, a lot of people in Milwaukee are very proud of and very cognizant of the great historical tradition we have with Milwaukee architecture, but it doesn't get enough attention outside. I'll tell you a real quick anecdote if I can. Part of that research process that you mentioned before was me sifting through lots of journal articles, the architectural record, the Inland Architect, the Western Architect, the American Architect. And when you're sifting through, as I did, hundreds and hundreds of hours of just sifting through articles, looking for references to Milwaukee, it goes like this: Chicago, 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 Milwaukee, Chicago, 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 Milwaukee, Chicago, Des Moines, Chicago, Chicago, Milwaukee. And I got the feeling after a while, you know, if I didn't know better, I would have thought that everyone in Milwaukee lived in grass huts. And yet when you get on the ground, as you say, in Milwaukee, the architecture is fabulous. It's world class. And you have, in just a short span of, you know, walking down the street, you can see all the great American architectural styles and very high quality versions of them.
This book is a second in a series, the first being Chicago in Stone and Clay. And you mention in the book that this is part of a series on architectural geology that you want to continue, focusing on Wisconsin and Illinois. Is there another book we should be looking forward to, or should we just enjoy this one for now as it's released and kind of see what comes in the future?
Well, by all means, enjoy this one now. Oh, you know, get out and use it now. But actually, this is part of a series, and I have a third contracted book on the way. What we're trying to do at NIU Cornell right now is sort of cycle back and forth between Chicago, Milwaukee, Chicago, Milwaukee. So the next book is on the Chicago suburbs, and I'm finishing up the manuscript on that now. By the way, lots of Cream City brick in the Chicago suburbs. So Milwaukee has had a tremendous influence on the whole Chicago area, too. But after that, I'm hopeful book number four will be on southeastern Wisconsin, exclusive of Milwaukee County. And hopefully that'll come out before too long, too.
Wonderful. Well, Ray, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect and for helping me think about time in the scale of millions of years and appreciating the fleeting moments that we have here together.
Sam, it's been a delight. Thank you very, very much.
Raymond Wiggers is a geologist and science writer who wrote the book Milwaukee in Stone and Clay, a guide to the Cream City's architectural geology. He spoke with Lake Effect Sam Woods, and you can find out more information about the book at WUWM.com. We want to hear from you as we gear up to cover local elections and the presidential election in November. You can have a say in our 2024 election coverage by filling out our election survey. You can find a link to that at WUWM.com. What you tell us will help inform the stories that you hear on Lake Effect and WUWM. Coming up, we'll explore the new dairy taking over the former Clock Shadow Creamery factory in Walker's Point. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. When it was first opened in 2012, Clock Shadow Creamery became the first cheese factory here in Milwaukee. The factory, located in Walker's Point, churned out curds, cork, and many other kinds of cheese for more than a decade. But when it closed its shop late last year, a lot of people wondered what would come next. The space has been taken over by Hill Valley Dairy owners Ron and Josie Henningfeld. The dairy has been producing cheese at the facility for many years, but now it's expanding its operations at the creamery and opening a new cheese bar. Lake Effect's Joy Powers headed over to the space in Walker's Point to chat with Ron.
You first started cheese making at Clock Shadow Creamery. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So Clock Shadow Creamery built this creamery and opened it up about 12 years ago. It was in 2012. And at that time, I was brought on board to be the first cheesemaker and manager of the place. So I've been involved in the creamer here in Milwaukee since the beginning.
Now, when did you branch out to have your own creamery?
Yeah, so I made cheese for 3 years for Clock Shadow Creamery, and then I took a little break to come back into cheese making as Hill Valley Dairy, my own business, which was ultimately my plan of getting into cheese making, because I come from a dairy farm and I wanted to learn cheese making as a way to eventually use milk from the family farm to make cheese. So I don't know if I answered your question.
When did you decide to branch out to your own creamery?
Oh, yeah. So Hill Valley Dairy established that and started making my own cheese in 2015. Started really small just by making cheese curds and some cheddars and selling it at farmers markets. And it's expanded to more types of cheese and cheese wholesale since then.
So in between being a Clock Shadow Creamery, going to your own creamery, how did your operations change?
I should share that when I started Hill Valley Dairy, the way I was able to start that is that Clock Shadow Creamery shared their space with me. So even starting Hill Valley Dairy, I was coming back to Clock Shadow Creamery, using the creamery here on days when they weren't producing cheese. So I would be here one day a week or one day every other week making cheese. And that involved transporting milk from my family's farm, which is just in East Troy, about 30 minutes down the highway, bringing it to the creamery here one day, the next day making cheese, and then taking it out of the creamery to store it, to sell it, to get it out to customers.
How much of your operation are you moving into Clock Shadow Creamery?
Sure. The creamery here in Milwaukee has been our production space, and it will remain our primary production space. So instead of one day a week, within a couple months, we'll be up to 3, 4, and then 5 days a week of making cheese in the space here. So it's our production space, and then it has the front end, which is the retail. And we are working on it right now, kind of reorganizing, refurnishing the retail space to open it up as the Hill Valley Cheese Shop and Hill Valley Cheese Bar.
So I am originally from Lake Geneva, so I've been to your original cheese bar.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of the plan for this space? Are you planning to have, you know, the same kind of food options, the same kind of bar?
Yes, similar idea, but kind of designed for the neighborhood here. So as a cheese bar, the way we describe it is we're a cheese forward bar. So you can get your drinks, but you can also get it, you know, flights of cheese and wine, your cheese and charcuterie boards. And in addition, here in Milwaukee, we will also offer craft cocktails that you can enjoy, you know, singularly, or it can be professionally matched up with cheeses as well to enjoy.
Interesting. So people who are familiar with the Clock Shadow space will be familiar with the cheese store that was here before, but although there is still the cheese shop that's open right now, it seems like things are really going to change.
Yeah, it will. The biggest change is kind of the cheese bar piece we were describing. So to let everybody know, yes, we will still be cheese retail. Within a couple months, we'll have a regular fresh cheese curd schedule, so customers can come in and expect those on certain days. And we'll have cheese retail. And then the cheese bar space where you can sit down and have that cheese experience with us, take your time to enjoy the cheese or learn more about the cheese and pair it up with a drink, that will be what really looks different versus the former Clock Shadow retail front. Yes.
Now, Bob, who previously ran Clock Shadow Creamery, continues to run Clock Shadow Creamery, I should say. He was really passionate about having a creamery in the city of Milwaukee, in part because I believe before Clock Shadow, there wasn't a creamery in Milwaukee, maybe ever.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And he was passionate about bringing it to Milwaukee because he has, from his youth, he was connected to Milwaukee. He was in Milwaukee. He just thought it was a city that could use a local creamery. Yeah.
What do you think about having your creamery in a space that is so urban that doesn't necessarily seem like the place where you'd be making cheese?
You're right. It is unusual. Though we're not the only urban cheese factory, it is rare. It is unusual. We like it. So my wife Josie and I, this is our project together, Hill Valley Dairy. And what works for us is that Josie and I also like people. So being in an urban environment where we're going to have customers, we're going to have more people, where we can do our part in, if people want to learn about cheese or learn about agriculture, they can learn about it, they can get connected with it, they can see it, both here at the creamery, and we'll probably in the future offer experiences that experiences in-house where you can, you know, sit with us and learn more, taste more, or even leave the city and visit, you know, farms and agriculture and get connected with that too. So we think it's a unique scenario and opportunity that we look forward to being or continuing is this urban creamery and urban cheese factory. Yeah.
Something I don't know how I've never noticed it before, but something that's unusual is there are very large windows looking right into where you make the cheese. Do you have people who stop and just watch what's going on?
We do. Yes, we do. We have windows on three sides of our production room here, so you can really see what's going on. Nothing's hitting. It's all out in front of you. So from the sidewalk, sometimes we have people, you know, see us working in there, and they'll lean against the window and trying to look in the best they can. But then from the retail sides, we have people looking in through the window as our retail staff can tell them what we're making for the day or what we're doing in the cheese making room.
What are you most excited for as you venture into this new project that is part of something you've been so passionate about for so long?
You know, what I'm most excited about is this next phase for Hill Valley Dairy means we're able to grow, because going from sharing a creamery space, like I described, you know, maybe one day a week being in here, to now having it full time and being able to bring more milk from the family farm here, making all of that into cheese. We're just excited to have a growth phase for Hill Valley Dairy where, I mean, ultimately we're still working on getting our business to a space where it's sustainable in terms of supporting our family and treating the team well, and so forth. So I guess we look forward to another phase of growth and being able to reach more people with the cheeses we make and the story that comes with it.
Do you have plans for any new kinds of cheese now that you have 5 days a week?
Yeah, as a cheesemaker, I have what I call cheese dreams. Those are dream cheeses I'd love to make. So yes, we hope to, without naming some specific cheeses, because then I might be held accountable to it. We do plan to make a couple more fresh styles of cheeses to go along with the cheese curds and, you know, take advantage of our unique location where we can make a fresh cheese and have it in customers' hands, you know, the same day or next day. And then I also have some more ideas for what we'll call like wheels of cheese that are, you know, very flavorful and well-aged as well. So yes, we can anticipate more cheeses, some new cheeses as part of the Hill Valley Dairy lineup now that we can produce more.
Ron Henningfeld is the owner and cheesemaker for Hill Valley Dairy, which has taken over the Clock Shadow Creamery space in Milwaukee's Walker's Point neighborhood. Henningfeld spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. The Milwaukee School of Engineering's Grohmann Museum specializes in merging art and industry, and its latest exhibit fully embodies this principle. Patterns of Meaning, the Art of Industry, features salvaged enormous wooden casting patterns from old steel mills used in the late 1800s and early 1900s. These casting patterns were acquired by Pittsburgh artist and preservationist Corey Bonnet. Bonnet combines these historic artifacts with art, whether it's painting on the castings, using them as sculptures, or as forms to create new pieces in glass, ceramic, and more. To learn more about it, I met Bonnet at the Grohmann Museum as he was assembling the final pieces of the exhibit.
Originally, my interest in preservation surrounded abandoned buildings and buildings that were in danger of being demolished in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh's a very similar town to Milwaukee, industrial, considered Rust Belt, lots of beautiful buildings that were utilitarian that produced everything that built the United States. I saw that all those stories were somehow wrapped up in those structures, and that each time one of them was demolished, those stories were one step away from being lost and forgotten too.
So this collection you acquired along with scrap dealer Chip Barletto was a collection of wooden casting patterns from past steel mills in the area. But before we get into the art that we're surrounded by here, can you describe what these wooden casting patterns are for people who aren't familiar, you know, how they were originally made, what their function was?
Sure. So the majority of these are from the late 1890s, early 1900s, and a foundry pattern is a wooden form that would be used in sand casting steel components. They would take the wooden form and pack it in a box with sand and foundry sand, remove the form, pour the steel in, and then you have the steel part that would then be machined. What's interesting and overwhelming about this whole collection is that when it was originally created for the building of the steel mills in the Ohio, Pennsylvania areas, there was no CAD, there was no CNC machining, no computers, no electricity in many of the mills. All of this was done, with hand-drawn designs passed on to pattern makers who built every single one of these thousands of patterns by hand without a CNC machine. Then casting it and, again, machining those cast steel parts without the advantage of any technology that we take for granted today.
Yeah, the energy and the power you feel walking into these space and being so close to these objects, being able to touch them, you can tell the attention to detail and the craftsmanship that was incorporated into every single one of these pieces. So what's it like for you to work with them, to not just put your hands on these objects, but you've painted on some of them, you've modified some for different art, but they've already stood so much testing of time and now they even have more life to them.
I think what is remarkable to me is how many of these pieces are already works of art in and of themselves. Probably the pattern makers who originally constructed them never thought of themselves as artists, but it is a very high form craftsmanship, the techniques that they had to use in order to make these complex forms, many times within tiny tolerances so that these pieces could eventually fit together to make the machines that made everything. You mentioned that, there's kind of this overwhelming feeling. There's a grandeur to it all that I think steel and the steel industry encompasses, this scale that's just beyond anything that I was ever exposed to. But there's also, with all these patterns, you can feel the human touch. You can immediately sense that these things took hundreds of thousands of man hours to produce. We have 10 26-foot truckloads of patterns that we removed and are stored in my studio in the Energy Innovation Center in Pittsburgh. And once people find out you use these things, you get offered more. So we have a warehouse at our disposal with three floors, probably five times the amount of the collection we have. Again, all made by hand. And all of these things are just pieces that need to be put together and assembled to create something, far greater than the sum of the parts.
You mentioned grandeur, but also I feel like also a sense of grounding.
Absolutely. So I used to get apprehensive about starting large projects and nervous about the timelines that some things could take if something was extended too long. When you see what it takes to build a steel mill, which is something I never thought of, and understand that it was people without any of the technology that we take for granted, your idea of what's possible starts to expand. It is eye-opening to see what was accomplished 100 years ago, 150 years ago. And here I am, I'm just painting. I'm not trying to build the power grid or the sewer lines under a city. It opens up all these possibilities. You see what humans were capable of when they use the technology at their disposal as a tool. It's the human spirit and human ingenuity that's the driving force, and I believe that's still true today. We need to understand that we control the technology, not the other way around.
You mentioned you are painting and using these as a tools for this exhibit. So can you share more about what you do with your artwork and how you elevate these tools of the past with your painting and also some of the artists that you brought in for this exhibit?
Well, I think it's copacetic. These patterns elevate my work. You know, when you have something that is so precisely crafted next to a traditional representational oil painting, it adds an element of interest to it immediately. When you pair it with some of the work our other artists are doing, so Mia Tarducci is an abstract painter, kind of wrestling with this idea of industry and how to present it in a fresh way for new audiences. When her work is paired with it, somehow it kind of crosses that time boundary where it's not something brand new and unapproachable. It becomes something familiar, even though in some cases it's not, literally representational of the steel mill. It's more of this feeling, this expression. Looking at this, again, this continuous timeline, steel, I look at it all as a story. The story's doesn't have an ending yet. We're still manufacturing. We still need people to work in manufacturing for everything that we do every day. And watching the other artists work with this, like Brian Engel, our glass artist, AJ Collins, our ceramics artist, Nate Lucas, who, just an incredible wood artist, how they're carrying the torch forward on these lost art forms where automation is taking over and mass production. Artists are kind of a last refuge for hand-built craftsmanship where you can really take your time and what you're producing and keep those traditions alive.
And we're in the perfect home for that, right? Like the Grohmann Museum is the perfect place to bring all this together. And this is the first museum exhibit that you have for this collection, taking it outside of Pittsburgh. So can you share a bit about your experience and how this partnership came to be and how you feel we're in the stages of you finalizing it, putting this exhibit together? And already it's looking amazing, but everything is blending so well together, even though it's multiple artists in one space.
Like a lot of things, all these collaborations with the other artists, meeting James at the Grohmann, they all kind of happen by accident or just organically. The president of the Steel Founders Society of America, Raymond Monroe, had seen my work online and kind of said, "Hey, have you ever heard of the Grohmann?" One of James's friends, Chris Winters, I believe is his name, as mutual friends on Facebook, said, "James, you should contact this guy." And, I had never heard of the Grohmann. I wasn't familiar. There's so many museums in the United States I'm not familiar with. But as soon as I saw it, I was like, I can't believe I didn't know about this. And the fact that it's inside a Milwaukee School of Engineering, it's this multi-layer connection that I love. What we have presenting here, there's fine art, there's ceramics, but all of them have industrial applications. Engineers are going to love it because they're going to look at these patterns and try to figure out how the heck did they build these. Mm-hmm. And from James visiting our exhibit hall studio in the Energy Innovation Center in Pittsburgh, we're in a gymnasium of a former trade school, to driving up here in a on the second trip in a 26-foot box truck through the first big winter storm of the year, to actually coming across the finish line, it is absolutely amazing. I could not have asked for a better venue or better people to work with.
What do you hope that people who come see this exhibit, whether they have a background in engineering or whether they're learning about castings for the first time, what do you hope they take away?
I really hope that the images inspire. I hope that they can help to unlock an understanding of how essential the work that was done to build all the infrastructure that we take for granted today, how unbelievably difficult our lives would be if we didn't have that as our foundation, and then to be optimistic about the future because we are working on this amazing foundation with all the technological advances at our disposal. I think that when you see what was overcome in the past, just through sheer will, determination, and an outlook of, we're going to do this to make things better for the future, when you see what they accomplished and you look at where we sit today at the starting point, I think a lot of the problems seem much more manageable and that there's opportunity for people to solve them.
Well, Corey, thank you so much for sharing more and for sharing your work with Milwaukee.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Corey Bonnet is an oil painter, preservationist, and the creator of the exhibit Patterns of Meaning, The Art of Industry. You can see it now at MSOE's Grohmann Museum in downtown Milwaukee through April 28th. You'll find pictures of the exhibit and more information at wuwm.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear from a South Carolina public radio reporter who recently covered the primary there and shares a name with WUWM reporter Mayan Silver. Plus, we'll tell you about a new book about how bird enthusiasts work together to save a park. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.